You were giving us kind of the rundown of your different positions as a judge, mm-hmm. the supervisor,
okay.
and so forth.
And, okay. All of the civil trial courtrooms were put in one section, the civil trial section, and I was the supervising judge of that because, okay, the treatment of cases, that's where I left off. Because a lot of cases shouldn't necessarily have been in the personal injury jury rooms. What should affect... it's all about what's called differentiated case management. The cases are not managed just on the basis of the amount of controversy or even just on the basis of whether there's a personal injury. For example, many of the cases that are filed are really filed by insurance companies for medical payments. Well, that is a liquidated amount, and the case depends solely on the bills. Pain and suffering and questions like that are never an issue, even though some of the medical payments may be for pain and suffering, but the point is they're paid by the insurance company, so they are now liquidated. Well, that case is no more complicated than a non-personal injury case. So unless a jury demand was filed, all of those cases would go to the 11th floor and get handled with the rest of those liquidated damage cases. With there being just one section, one judge was able to effect those transfers. I was presiding judge of the civil trial section and concurrently the supervising judge of the mandatory arbitration program. Now, supervising judge of mandatory arbitration did not mean that I handled the nuts and bolts of the arbitration system. An administrator did that. I simply handled the legal aspects. And the judge who had that position first had a courtroom over at the ARB Center, but he was so very seldom on the bench that it was felt that I could do that. He went eventually into the law division, and he got the whole thing started. But really, all of the significant jurisprudence in that area was set and settled while I was supervising judge. So a little bump in the road for Judge Jones when you are attempting to do a significant reform, you're going to step on somebody's toes. And there were lawyers who griped about the enforcement of standards and things like that. So even though all of the other, when I ran for retention in 1992, all other bar associations found me either highly qualified or qualified. The Chicago Bar Association found me not recommended because they said Judge Jones was arrogant, arbitrary, and inflexible. Well, I suppose when it came to managing old cases, I was inflexible. I suppose that if you think that a judge should not be in control, I suppose that's arrogant. And of course, arbitrary is a very, can be a very nebulous term. But in response to that, I wrote an extensive letter to the Law Bulletin. And if I had, I should have anticipated that the interview would go that way, I'd have brought it for you. I can get it to you if you like. In which I talk about the tension that exists between lawyers and judges, and how lawyers need standards, and judges are the only ones who can enforce them. Because there's 10,000 lawyers, there's only 400 judges. And actually, when you look at the judges who are in the trial courts, there's less than a dozen of them, and there's thousands of lawyers who go there. So lawyers can't do it. Now, it is true that every time a lawyer comes before a judge, the lawyer really does need that continuance. That's true. But it is also true that the lawyer's request for a continuance is probably a function of the lawyer's unsuccessful attempt to manage uncertainty in the courthouse in some other areas. And only judges can manage that, can get rid of that uncertainty. So that's where we started. And it had, all of it had a kind of a trickle-up effect into the law division, because our judges, our better judges, having learned this would go up to the law division, the younger lawyers who were improving and getting more experience were going into the law division. So when Judge O'Connell finally became the chief judge, or the presiding judge of the law division, he was able to get the law division well on its way because of what we had done together in the first municipal district. And so, but I did, of course, I did win my my retention. And I did so by not ever picking a fight with the Chicago Bar Association, but by using it as simply an opportunity to educate the bar and the public on case management issues. And after the retention campaign, everything settled down, and we were a smooth operation. Well, in 1998, I ran again for retention, got found qualified by everybody this time. And after that, I was transferred to the Chancery Division. The Chancery Division handles injunctions, a lot of cases between the government and people, between different branches of government, business dissolutions, personal trust disputes, receiverships of large companies and buildings, and a lot of stuff like that. A lot of potentially very complicated stuff. Well, I've always been of the view that a case is as complicated as the judge lets it become. Okay, and the best way to control that is to set a firm trial date. So using everything that I had learned in First Municipal, I grabbed a hold of my calendar, which was 10% of the caseload. I had a new calendar, and I got 100 cases from each of the other 13 calendars. So I started off with 1,300 cases, virtually all of them old dogs, or many of them old dogs. And before the year was over, they were just about all gone. And I ended up with the lightest caseload in the division. And all this time I was getting my fair share of the new cases, you see. So I mentioned the Intercounty Trust Company as an important case that I handled. This was a case involving the theft of over $62 million by the owners of Intercounty Trust Company, who also owned Intercounty Title Insurance Company. Intercounty Trust? Inter something Trust. It was called Intrust. But anyway, they did it by shifting millions of dollars back and forth between the two companies. And when the state found out that $32 million less went this way than that way, they shut down both companies. And I had the trust company receivership. And the first several, or many of the first several, or actually all of the proceedings were initially in the presiding judge's courtroom, because there would be the first several of them, hundreds of people were there. I mean, there were, of course, many, many lawyers, many, many investment people, many, many investors and investor group people, press, all these kinds of people. And the attorney for the receiver said that the first thing to be done is we have to allocate how the loss, or we have to determine how the loss of this money is to be allocated among the shareholders. And judge, as complicated as this is going to be, it'll take 5 years. And I said, oh, no, it won't. It'll be over in a year. So just by, again, keeping a tight rein on everything, avoiding excessively long briefing schedules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The use of the intercounty website so that people could see what the orders were and everything. We did conduct loss allocation hearings, and an order was entered, and on appeal, everything involving allocation was affirmed. I did not get affirmed on attorney's fees, but I figured I wouldn't, but I wanted to enter some order there so that the whole case could go up. Otherwise, they'd have been fiddling around with attorney's fees for a couple of years, and I wasn't with that. So I was very proud of that. Now, in other areas where I had sensitive litigation, for example, lawsuits between lawyers who are part of dissolving law firms can be very bitter. Family disputes over family trusts, very bitter. And on all of those, whenever I would recognize such a case coming up, I usually would come up for the first... Well, my cases would get called up for the first time for a case management conference when they were 6 months old. That would be the normal course of things. Well, a lot of times a lawyer would come in on a motion to appoint a special process server. And I cut out the practice of them getting that or just being able to drop those orders off, because that meant that something unusual was happening in the case, and I'd want to know about it. Well, it would turn out it would be a family trust. Well, we can't sue Billy because Billy won't be served. Well, okay, I understand that. But let's have a case management conference next week. You notify everybody who's on board, and we'll just go ahead without Billy, and Billy can catch up later. And so I was able to get those cases under control because I was convinced that the only thing that would happen in the passage of time is bad. So, and it would make the case more complex. So that's how I would manage those highly sensitive cases. And... now, why did I retire from the bench? Well, as I was, my wife and I saw a presentation of a marketing company, and we decided that we would join it. Of course, I couldn't because a judge can't be a part of a business. But the business taught financial education. And, you know, when you're in school, you don't learn that. Not even the finance majors and the marketing majors. They learn how to manage somebody else's finances. They don't learn how to create finances for themselves. And so I messed around, and now because I hang around my wife a lot, I got to hanging around her business partners and messed around and picked up a financial education for myself, which you don't get in law school either. And I found this knowledge creeping into my presence as a judge. For example, in a pretrial conference, people would discuss what their client's assets were. Well, oh, my client has this home. I said, well, the home's not an asset. He said, well, yes, sure, it's an asset. It's, you know, the home doesn't make him any money. He has to spend money for his home. So lawyers would exchange glances at me. Well, that's how I looked at home. And and I learned that people struggle financially because they have poor wealth mentalities, meaning that they have a wealth allocation mentality. And that simply means that somebody else is responsible for your financial well-being, usually the job. Well, the problem is you don't own your job. You don't own the desk you sit at. You don't own the telephone they don't want you talking too much on. You just don't own it. And it's just not the job's job to look out for the financial security of the employees. It's the job's job to keep the employees and pay them as little as possible so the employees can make somebody else's babies wealthy. I mean, that's what a job is, isn't it? Okay. I'm not saying a job is bad because a job supports people's lifestyles. But the biggest problem with wealth allocation mentality is that wealth is not something that is allocated. It is created, the way Bill Gates created Microsoft out of almost nothing. So I began looking at litigation as wealth allocation mentality in my courtroom. Judge, he allocated something from me. I want you to allocate it back. And that perspective is not necessarily of benefit to parties who are interested in redress for what they feel are redress for legal remedies. It's a good perspective in terms of helping to settle a case or to mediate a case, but it's not so good. It sometimes conflicts with the overall importance of the judge's primary job, which is to judge each case on the facts and the evidence that are before the judge. Now, of course, it can be said, well, that's just background information that's good for judges in general, just like all other experiences in life are good for judges in general. Well, maybe so, but I felt a conflict. So, and in fact, one day in the middle of that Intercounty Trust Company case, I started to give a wealth creation presentation right in front of, right from the bench in front of 100 onlookers, and right away that convinced me that I needed to go, so that's why I retired. In retrospect, I think I wish I had stayed on a little bit longer. That way I would have stayed on. I only needed to stay on about 2.5 more years and I'd have gotten my full retirement. Or 3.5 more years, I'd have gotten my full retirement. And I struggled a little bit learning the business because all of the habits that I had accumulated were really not good for a marketing company. You know, I was a Marine Corps officer. I was a lawyer where people paid. Well, I was a Marine Corps officer where people did what I told them to do. I was a lawyer where people paid me to do what I told them to do. Then I became a judge where, with the stroke of a pen, people did what I told them to do. And besides which, I became judgmental. Well, judges are supposed to be judgmental. So those are exactly the skills that you don't need in a marketing company. So I've had to struggle with that, but I enjoy, I've enjoyed the experiences and the people I've met and being able to be helpful to people in that regard. And I've kept my fingers in the legal pie a little bit. I've done some arbitrations and mediations. I prefer mediations to arbitrations. A mediation is when you help people make their own decision, reach their own decision, and arbitration is when you decide. And an arbitration is just like a bench trial. Well, I retired from the bench, so I wouldn't have to do that. So I much prefer mediations. Mm-hmm. I have not practiced law. Whenever people tell me they have a legal problem, I tell them you need a lawyer. One friend asked me to come in at the very last moment on a matter. So I'm doing that, and I'm about to get out of it, and I've regretted it. That's why I'm not engaged in the practice of law.
Mm-hmm. How, what year was it that you retired?
2001.
Okay.
April.
And you're still with your marketing firm?
Yes. It's called My Econ. Small M, small Y, capital E, C-O-N, one word. Short for My Economy. It reminds us that that we have a great deal of interest, or a great deal of control over our own personal economy. But yet, if you go to a Starbucks or someplace and you hear people talk and a half an hour hasn't gone by and you've heard all the world experts solving all of the economic problems of the world, the country, the locality, everything, but they haven't solved their own. And you know what? That's also true of our congresspeople, our state legislators, and our aldermen, and our county commissioners. And that's not their fault because they come from us, you see, but who said we have a financial education? 5% of America has a financial education, and they learned it at the dining room table. They didn't learn it at school.
Do you have any final stories or thoughts you want to share about the law or your time as a judge even?
I enjoyed every single second from the moment I started on the bench until the very last second of my last day. I enjoyed the lawyers, all of them. I felt that I was productive and of benefit to the bench, the bar, the public, and to my community in particular, because I was sensitive to the needs, particularly of people with whom I grew up, but everybody else too, which is something else that's worth me going back on. During my first retention, I was, or first election, I was being questioned by the gay and lesbian lawyers, and they asked me, well, what do you do to keep gay and lesbian lawyers from being discriminated against? And I said, well, first of all, there's much too much going on in my room for me to take notice of anything like that. I just control my courtroom, and there's not enough time for lawyers to take advantage of undue advantage of each other for any reason. And if I see it, I clamp down on it. For example, once a man and a woman came before me, these were lawyers, and they introduced themselves to me before, as they were coming up, and it was obvious to me that they did not know each other or had not met each other before. So the fellow starts saying, well, Judge such and such and so, and Mary and I thought, and I said, that's Attorney Smith. Oh, yes, Judge. And Mary thought that, I said, that's Attorney Smith. Well, Judge such and such and so, and Mary really thinks that. So I just kind of lean back in my seat and stop. And the whole courtroom gets really, really quiet. My wife says that sometimes I get a look on my face. Well, the whole room got quiet. Because, you know, you're not supposed to talk in court, but if you're ever in a court, you see how somebody, you hear, and you hear the clerks talking to the whole counsel. Stone quiet, you could hear a pin drop. I said, counsel, you've called this lawyer by her first name 3 times. I've reminded you 3 times that you're not to do that. Please don't do that again in this or any other courtroom. Well, Judge, I was just trying. I said, I know what you were trying to do, and I won't have it in this courtroom. So things like that happened. That's how I usually addressed it. And so I very, very, very seldom ever had to put anybody in their place about anything, because my reputation circulated about the courthouse. And sometimes when I speak in front of kids groups, high school students, they ask, did you use the gavel? I said, no, I never had to. And as a circuit judge, it's our responsibility to elect associate judges. If, for example, there are 25 openings, there may be 400 lawyers who apply for them. The circuit court selection committee selects from that 400 twice as many who are to be elected. So 50 people are running, and as the candidates would come in, I would tell all of them. I spoke with every single person who ever ran as an associate judge, and I had the same conversation with all of them, because I said the chances are only 50% of you becoming a judge. Actually, there's 75, because people who don't get it done this way run again and they become a judge, or they do something else that gets them in a similar area. So chances are 75% that you're going to be a judge. So this conversation's worthwhile. And I talked about just 2 things. I talked about court management with the importance of getting litigation out of people's lives, and I talked about racial fairness and how the best way to assure it is to make sure that everybody is following the same rules. And so now I'm in the business of teaching people how to be free of debt and how to invest properly so that they can retire. And that's a need really in everybody's community. Some people, whenever I'm talking to somebody I know in my community, they'll say, well, that's something we really need to know. And I say, well, wait, do you know that there's 300 million people in the country. There's $15 trillion worth of personal wealth. That's $50,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. That's no wealth, because if you invest that and get 10%, that's only $5,000 a year. You can't live off of $5,000 a year. Now, if we take all of the black folks and all of the Hispanics out of that equation, that's $250,000, or 250 million people. If you divide 250 million into 15 trillion, the answer is $60,000. Well, 10% of that is $6,000. Now, you don't want to live off of $6,000 any more than you didn't want to live off of $5,000. So you see, white folks don't have it either. They're broke too. And if you don't believe it, just let me take you to any overpass of the Kennedy Expressway and see all of them driving in to jobs they don't want. And every single one of them are a paycheck or two away from financial disaster, just like everybody else. Now, it's true that when the economy hiccups, the black community gets a convulsion. That's true. That community is more vulnerable. But it is not true that black people are the only ones who lack financial education. See, if 95% of Americans don't have it, that must be a whole lot of white folks. Mm-hmm. Are there any other specific questions or concerns that I can address that I haven't? Because if you ask me something, I'll probably think of something else too.
Something else you wanted to add. You answered a lot of our questions along the way.
Oh, okay. Okay, well.
Our themes anyway, mm-hmm. that we had in our head. Unless you have anything else you'd like to add.
Well, I think that part of my effectiveness as a judge was because I was not connected with any establishment of lawyers. I was active in the Cook County Bar Association. I was not super active in the Chicago Bar Association. I wasn't one of the collections lawyers. I wasn't one of the defense lawyers. So I came there with a fresh set of open eyes. And when the lawyers, at first the lawyers were a little nervous about things, but when they saw that everything was even-handed and gave them predictability, they began to appreciate it, and a lot of them made a lot more money. And all of them worked very, very hard to get us to where we ultimately came. And that's why I say that I just have a great deal of respect for lawyers.
Well, I guess we can wrap up the interview then. Judge Jones, thank you again very much for all your time and your information and your answers. We appreciate it. And
anything you wanted to add? Just thank you for giving us the opportunity to interview you.
Okay. Now, do you want that letter that I wrote?
If you wouldn't mind, I think that would be great.
I wouldn't mind at all.
I think it would be wonderful. Okay. I think Dr. Manning would love that as well.
Okay. To whom and how shall I send it?
Do you want to send an email or do you want to send it like in the mail?
Well, let's see. I'm not sure if I have it electronically. Yes, I do. I did it on a computer, so I do have it electronically. I can probably email it to you, it would come in WordPad or Works rather than Word.
That's okay. Not a problem at all.
Okay, so
the interview is ending. It's about 12:45 on Saturday.